to experiment with psychedelics before you knocked me up. We never had that three-way in the heart of Paris, and now we're all grown up. Know how we used to be blue sky walkers and pipe dream talkers. Now our feet are firmly on the ground. Baby, I love our life, but I don't want us at all. So angry is the reason I get sad. Just look around, we're not the only ones going crazy. Baby, the whole world's mad. I know they like to hear us talking lighter or locked down tighter. So what happens if we all get loud? You know I love this life, so I don't wanna settle.
That was Goodnight Moonshine with Settle Down, and you're listening to Northern Remedy, the show on WNHHLP 103.5 FM, dedicated to New Haven's music, past, present, and future. I'm your host, Brian Slattery. I'm the arts editor of the New Haven Independent, and with me here today in the studio are Molly Vender and Eben Pariser of Goodnight Moonshine. Hey, guys.
Hey, Brian.
Hi, Brian.
Thanks so much for coming in.
Pleasure to be here.
So before we talk about you guys, I want to talk about the song itself. So, did you write this song together, or did one of you write it and have the other person sing slash play it?
I wrote this one. Some songs I will write a good chunk of and then have Eben come in and help, but I think I wrote all the words anyway and most of the melodies, and then Eben did all the arrangements.
Is that a typical work arrangement?
That does happen a lot. It's not the only way we do it, but that does happen a lot because I really like writing and Eben really likes composing. And
yeah, the fun of this one, especially though, and three of the other tracks on the record, is it features Roosevelt Dime as the backing band. And so that gives it
now,
a...
Now, Roosevelt Dime is a project that you've been heading up for how long? Many years, I should say.
I think since 2009, yeah. It became Roosevelt Dime, although... We kind of started a new lineup in 2014 that's been really exciting and new. So having them back up Molly and having a real band sound,
right.
You know, makes the track totally different than just going into the studio with an assortment of musicians and playing parts on the page or parts that we've taught them.
For sure.
And it was cool, too, because we produced this. Well, Eben produced this with his good friend Adam Chalensky, and he plays upright bass with Goodnight Moonshine, and they've known each other since grade 5. And Adam watched a concert where I sang, and Roosevelt Dime backed me up, and he independently was like, oh, yeah, that should be the backing band for several of these tracks, you know? And he's producing it, and he's playing bass right. on the rest of it. So he, like, he wrote himself out of some of the songs.
I was pleased because I feel like it would have been inappropriate for me to try to. It wouldn't have crossed my mind to do it that way,
yeah.
and I felt like it would have been a potentially conflict of interest or something to try to push my band on this project or on Molly. But then he saw it, he said, you know,
why are you guys using this band?
What's that? He says, yeah. Exactly. Like, you guys are a band. You guys are a band. You've been playing together for as long as you have, and I think it's starting to pay off. Like, you guys have this band thing, and so why would we not use that on the record? And I said, okay, Molly, are you okay? Is that good? And she said, sure. So over a really expensive meal of sushi on Essex Street or something in the East Village after the show,
it was decided.
Adam sprung for sushi for all of us, and that was it.
Nice. So on the nerdy songwriting end of things, I really appreciate the extra beat in the beginning of each of the verses, I guess it is, right?
Ooh, explain.
That there's that phrase lasts like one beat longer than it might.
Than it could.
Not than it
needs
to.
Yeah, right.
I think it's great the way it is.
That's cool. I like to be a little bit weird with phrasing. And so I think then it ends up being like an extra beat. And I'm not even aware of it. I should know more about that stuff.
No, I was going to say extra according to certain genres, but to other genres, that sort of thing is totally normal.
Right. Yeah. You know? No, that I like to turn around phrases around the ends of where a line would end and then like keep them going into the next line. And so sometimes fun things happen with beats because of it.
Now, is that
just for the music nerds out there? I'm not sure there's an extra beat there, but I know it feels like one. We don't know. We're not going to do this, Brian.
There is.
Yes.
Or it's not four. It's not four and then four. It's like there's a four.
I've said my piece. I've said my piece on.
it's more about, so how did you, have you always written songs that way, or was it something that sort of developed over time, or
you mean like process wise or how they end up, like content?
Like the first couple of songs that you wrote, did they have similar kind of like fun phrasing in it, or was that something that you sort of explored as
that's interesting. Because I've always kind of written with the same process since forever, just like kind of strumming around and making nonsensical words, and then all of a sudden a few words will come out and then a few more, and then I'll say, oh, that's what this song is about, and then you know, at a certain point I can start patching things in, but I don't go into it with an idea of what it's about. And so then in terms of lyrically craft wise I'd have to dig deep. I mean, I'm not like proud of the earliest songs I wrote or anything, but they do.
That says it should.
They
be,
do
I
come
think.
Out. Yeah, of course. Like, who would be? But they do come out a little bit. Maybe the way I talk, or the way I wish I talk, if I were super eloquent.
If you had time to phrase everything exactly.
Yeah, there's kind of a natural cadence that's a little bit quirky. Yeah,
I would say just having worked with Molly, that the precision and quality of the phrasing is one of the notable and special parts about her performance. It's it's just interesting and precise.
Well,
it's fun for me.
Well, part of my own musical background is in sort of the old country music, which is full of stuff like that. You know, where it's just about somebody wrote a melody and they didn't care how many beats long it was. And it was up to the rest of the band to figure out how to make that still like danceable.
Right. Like, oh yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's old country music is full of stuff like that. You know, that doesn't fall neatly around four beats per measure or, you know, things like that.
Right. And then I think I got the trickle down effect, because what I was listening to was already like three waves into folk and just kind of alternative indie.
Sure.
The songs were not, didn't have like a structure that was set. I actually sometimes try to get more of a structure, because left to my own devices, they're not, you know, they're not, they don't have like a catchy memorabilia. Sometimes they're just like too wordy. And so if I do anything, I consciously think about like, you know what? I think I understand why people put bridges in now, because it gives your brain a chance to relax. Like, yeah, you don't have to just keep hitting and hitting with this content. So yeah, I think about that more these days.
So meanwhile, this song appears to be sort of vaguely autobiographical, or it's tempting to think of it that way.
Yeah, this one is totally autobiographical. There's mm-hmm. maybe one or two that will sound autobiographical, but they're more like imagined versions of what we have gone through as a
sure.
couple.
Right.
But yeah, this one is just straight up like, these are our thoughts, these are our feelings, this is the push-pull.
You know, one of my best friends always pressures me to admit that Molly's actually writing through my eyes on that song.
But
I couldn't admit that because I had no idea what the truth was. It's funny. I think
no way. It's all me, of course. But I think we both. I think it's just like that's a universal feeling that I think both people would feel.
Well, I'm not surprised for you to say that it's all you. that's not supposed to sound that way, actually. But I do think it's an interesting terrain with songwriting in general, where you know, like acting, you do draw on personal experience, but I mean, being that I kind of live it and it's my job, I never find myself asking or curious or wondering about, you know, is this your personal experience? Is it, because right. of course it is and of course it isn't.
It's a total shell game, right? I mean, that question always is, you know, is it autobiographical? Like, yes, and also not really.
Right.
But also kind of.
Yeah.
But what kind of a biography is 3.5 minutes long, first of all? So it couldn't, I mean, it, right. if anything, it chronicles a moment or a thought or yes. one tiny piece of something.
Right.
Yeah.
But for me, for my purposes, it's a good segue to ask how the two of you met.
Mm. Delightful. We were at, was it 6 years ago, 7 years ago? We were at a folk music business conference. It's called the Folk Alliance International Conference, and it's thousands of musicians and hundreds of booking people all shoved in a hotel. This one was in Memphis, and you like play in these little hotel rooms and try to hawk your wares for people. But the best thing that usually comes out of it is you meet other wonderful musicians. And yes. so the band I was touring with at the time, Red Molly, met Eben's band, Roosevelt Dime, and we just took like a band liking to each other, I would say. We started doing a songwriting group.
I mean, I think Laurie liked me.
Yeah, my bandmate liked Eben. Somebody else probably liked somebody else. There was a lot of
I was so
wires.
Fresh and starry-eyed. I was all dressed up. I was like handing out chocolates in the lobby to anybody who would listen.
Yeah.
And Laurie was very impressed with the whole pitch.
Yeah, she's like, you guys, we gotta go to see this band. We gotta go see them. So we went and saw them. And then, and then we got back to Brooklyn. We started a songwriting group with them and a few other songwriters. And
so you didn't
leave out the
headbutting. I mean, no, you're right. That's when the stars really aligned.
We're bored of this story. This is like an every night on stage story.
It's pretty good, though.
But it's pretty good.
Tell it.
No, okay. You always
tell it. I'm assuming it's well rehearsed if it's part of the stage band.
Not for me, because she always tells
yeah,
it.
Yeah, you do it now. Let's hear your side.
Well, we had one new member of the band at the time. We had a new trumpet player, and he is just going through a divorce, and it was like a big weekend away from his kid and stuff. We were driving down to Memphis, and so things were getting crazy, and we were having a lot of fun in the van, and we invented a game called Try to Hug Me, which is...
that totally sounds like a van game.
Is yeah. it? No, you don't play it in the van.
Van
you need to be standing.
Dorm
Something
room.
You think
yeah.
of
slash, yeah.
in the van.
Basically, it's hard to explain exactly on the radio, but you challenge someone to try to hug, and then you evade them using various physical barrier methods or psychological methods or, you know, distraction methods. And the idea is to keep them from hugging you. And so we were playing it with various people at the conference, and we challenged Molly to it. Molly is like a varsity athlete. She was like team captain of three sports in college. And so, she was playing to win, and
I, you didn't stand a chance.
And I did the move. If you just drop your chin to your chest and push it, like if you imagine just nodding all the way down to your head is just sticking out at 90 degrees from your body. It's pretty much
like
impossible to hug someone.
You're unhuggable at that
point.
Yeah,
you're pretty unhuggable at that point. But she just went in for the kill, like hard
looking.
And strong. And I just straight up headbutted her in the nose in the process and thought that I had certainly... I thought everything was over now. I thought we were leaving. We're going,
going to
you know, like,
hospital.
I'm not going to be allowed here anymore.
Now,
we're
this,
going to the
was
hospital.
Was this in Memphis? Was
yeah.
This
isn't that yeah. Memphis. The first time we met in the hallway. Yeah. After we saw them, but still in the hallway, them and their shenanigans. So yeah, we smashed heads.
And I looked up at her and I just was expecting to see a horror show. And she was just looking back at me so stoically. And she said very quietly, "It's okay."
I was like, "It's cool. It's okay. Moving on."
And I was...
So you didn't know each other at all when this game occurred?
Correct.
Nice.
Correct.
This is this does sound like things that happen at a conference like this.
Yeah, totally.
Right.
And then I see him in the hallway later that night, and he's just like, "Do you know where the stairs are?" And I was like, "Oh my gosh." So yeah, they were being silly, and...
She's trying to say I was heavily intoxicated, yeah. I think is what she's trying to explain.
Evan had heard it was like a total party scene. It's not exactly that way.
It's really strange. All these folkies that have shows that shuffle in at 7:30 and if the show goes after 10 start to complain, only drink tea and coffee during the set and never alcohol. And they all stay up till 4 in the morning.
4 in the morning.
Yeah, and so it's just totally nonsensical.
Yeah. So anyway, that's where we met. And then, but it was like our bands kind of having a crush on each other and started making music together and we started collaborating.
So
and then
you discovered that you both lived in Brooklyn at the conference.
Yeah. Or yeah. Was I? No, I was still living in Austin, Texas, but my band was in Jersey City and Eben was in Brooklyn. And so I was always...
We were all, but Roosevelt time at that time was all in Brooklyn.
You're all Brooklyn. Yeah. So I was spending a lot of time in New York because the band was set there and I grew up in New Haven. So I'd be in and out and I started spending more time and Evan made a pitch and we went on a date. Yeah, but it was a couple months after that Folk Alliance. And then it was no turning back.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
Yeah.
That's actually a very sweet story considering it involves... low-level physical violence.
Yeah, like a violent headbutting. Yeah. Yeah, it was pretty cool. It's one of those twinkly... When it finally took, it was like a very sparkly moment. And I was just like, oh, I just thought it was all about hard work, but there can be a little bit of magic. And then we dove right back into the hard work because we had a kid and got married. So that's what a lot of our songs are about. Just like, what is this? What are we doing?
We should hear another one of them then.
Okay, hear another one. Evan, should I do maybe January Skies? Because that's kind of fun. So you just heard the real way that we met, but I didn't think it was good for songwriting. So when I was like in love, just falling in love with Evan and I was writing the song about it, I made up all new details to kind of glorify Austin that I was feeling like that was home. And so the feelings are real in January Skies, although you'll see the details are fictional.
Awesome. Let's hear it.
I remember it was 4:30 Austin. You were all mischief in your eyes. I was seeing sand-colored moonbeams falling from the January skies. And there was a drunk out on the corner. You had stopped to give him 50 cents. And I've been working tables all night, so I wasn't watching where I went. Ooh, and in a flash our worlds collide. What did a thousand little moments make tonight? Ooh, you're saying life turns on a dime. Lights in the outdoor restaurants, and the moon dropped down behind us, and the sun started to rise as we walked over the river, singing Lucy in Disguise.
That was Goodnight Moonshine with January Skies. And you're listening to Northern Remedy here on WNHHLP 103.5 FM. And with me in the studio here are Molly Venter and Evan Pariser of Goodnight Moonshine, who are celebrating the release of the album that that song is off of. What is the name of this album? Because I suddenly can't read the... There it is. I Am the Only One Who Will Tell You You're Bad.
That's right. Which is an... The mouthful.
Would no, but it's also, I was about to say, is an excellent name for an album that's about a married relationship.
Yes! He gets it. Okay.
Yes. So you were just saying that this was sort of like your song version of How You Met, as opposed to the conference headbutting version of How You Met.
Exactly. This is the you can improve upon history, kind of make it more romantic.
Some of the details are from life too, right?
Yeah.
The sweatshirt one feels real.
Yeah. I don't think that was.
I mean, not with Eben, but with someone, surely.
Yes. That must have happened to somebody at some point on the East Coast.
I don't let the details stand in the way of a good story. Is that?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
But that's an unusual song for me to write. It's usually pretty more grounded in details. But I think all the details just like came up from living in Austin, Texas for 10 years. Like, this is where I would walk every day.
It's a love song to Austin.
It kind of is. But the love song to Evan is actually a love song to Austin, Texas. Like,
how am I going to do this? Well, I don't know how to write a love song to him, but I know something I love very much, and I can talk about that.
So did you start it when your personal relationship started? Did the musical relationship start at the same time?
No.
What do you think?
No, it started later. I mean, it started later. I threw you the changes to Willow Tree.
Mm-hmm.
We had a song we co-wrote, and not right away, and then it was never. It was discussed. It was discussed. We will never ever have a career together. We absolutely won't do that. And I was like, well, we could do something. And Molly was like, no, I never ever wanted to do that. You know how much pressure that will put. I don't want to go back to hustling my own brand, and I don't want to have all the. Can you imagine if we were just living together and working together and had all our finances tied together? That would be horrible.
Yeah, well, I can totally see how that would go either direction, right? Like, there are people who are married and they're in the same artistic project, and they go like, I can't imagine doing this any other way. And then there are people who see their marriage as like a refuge from,
right?
You know,
the
career,
work they do. Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And then there must be people, you know, on
everything in between
those two extremes, right?
Yeah.
Totally. Yeah, it still has been nice when we have different projects. Like, Evan will still go away with Roosevelt Dime.
I'll still go
He'll
away
still
sometimes.
He'll leave sometimes, and that's good.
It was hard. I mean, because we started out with a scenario, either one of us would be gone doing our thing for a week, 2 weeks at a time. We had lots of space to just be fiercely independent. And we have had that independence slowly but surely pried from our white fingers.
Well, I don't think it was slow. I think it was like the minute our son was born, it was like, you are no longer like operating for yourself.
Ah,
so everything everything's a conversation and a negotiation for
I didn't notice it at that point. I only noticed that I was sort of that we were stuck working with each other after a couple of, I realized when my son was born, obviously I had a new responsibility and my life was taking new shape.
Right.
But I didn't realize the closeness and, you know, finesse that we were going to have as a team.
Totally.
Until much later. And that was sort of breathtaking.
I mean, people always say being in a band is like a marriage, and it is. I mean, it is for Eben and his three dudes he's in a band with, and for me and Red Molly, what? Like, there's three women, and it is like, you've got to work through some stuff. It's
yes.
a challenge. You're living together nonstop. So, so it's, yeah, it's like a double magic here we have.
So how did you so for Molly, it's how did you come back to New Haven? But how did you end up back in New Haven?
Yeah, so I grew up here, and it was a family thing. My dad got sick and he passed away, and my mom was still living here, and my mom was like, I'm living in this big house. You guys are living in Brooklyn. Evan is a neuroscience major in college, and he was working at Rockefeller University, like with birds and science and their birdie brains. And he was doing music on the side. He was doing both. He was working part time there and then doing his music as much as he could.
I will ask you to refrain from talking about my research as birdie brains.
Anyway, studying Huntington's. I mean, serious stuff. But he knew he wanted to be a musician. So my mom was like, why don't you just not pay all that Brooklyn rent and come live with me? And so we came to New Haven.
Also, I mean, your father died.
I said that already.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. Just say it again. No, it's okay.
You don't have to throw me under the bus on that.
I know. so we all came. Even my brother kind of moved back to town, and I don't know. And now we love New Haven. I mean, we just bought a house in Hamden, right across the New Haven line. I was shocked because we were snobs, right? Evan had been living in Brooklyn for 10 years. I'd been living in Austin, Texas for 10 years, just like the cool places. And New Haven is so real and has so much going on. Like, it's not the burgeoning music scene that like Austin or New York is, but there's a ton of artists here. There are musicians here. There are social activists here. They're just like, you can make a difference in your own community. And that feels so exciting. And, yes. And we decided to buy a house and put down roots. So we love it.
Yeah. That was my experience also from moving here from New York. I remember moving here.
Why did you move?
Well, the show isn't about me. No, but it's a very long, you know, very short version is that my wife is a pediatrician and she did her residency here at Yale. So we moved here having absolutely no idea. I mean, I remember driving into New Haven with the moving truck being like, I don't know the first thing about this place that I'm moving to.
Yeah.
And then, you know, 3 years later, we're like, this place is all right.
Yeah.
And we just decided to stick around.
That should be New Haven's tagline. This place is all right.
But it was that it was like you say, though, you discover that the town is really interesting and has a lot to offer. And you go like, well, why, you know, at the end of a residency, we could have gone anywhere. And instead, we're just like, let's stay here and see what happens.
Yeah.
I was just talking to, a friend, my neighbor, actually. We took the kids to the pool, and then we got a chance to sit in the sauna for a little bit. We were just talking about New Haven, and I don't, you know, I don't want to be contentious at all. And I don't want this to sound that way. But sometimes it seems like all the things that people are attracted to big cities like Brooklyn or Austin, you know, diversity, culture, you know, art museums, and such, restaurants,
right?
New Haven has all that stuff, and then you get a lot of people from you get a lot of people from those cities that say like, oh, I'm sorry, you have to live in New Haven, and it's just like, so what's missing for you? It's just the brand of a city that makes you feel cool for living there because it's got a big brand that makes you feel validated as a person. So I mean, it's odd, I think, that because you imagine that what they're searching for is these very elements that this city has, but maybe not. Maybe people, you know, and I can speak from my own experience. Like when I moved to the city, I lived in Brooklyn for 9 years, right, in Fort Greene. I watched it change the whole time, and you know, I was into the idea of being from Brooklyn, and I liked that was my identity was kind of wrapped up in that, you know. It wasn't lost on me that was a cool thing, but then you see how millions of people are there for 2 or 3 years or 4 or 5 years, and then they leave, and the whole time they, you know, they're representing Brooklyn. There's, you know, 1,000 bands that lived in Brooklyn for 4 years and then aren't there anymore, and they were Brooklyn band this, Brooklyn band that, and there's nothing wrong with that. And at the same time, at this point in my life, I appreciate the fact that people are here in New Haven, you know, are here kind of for real or for the long term, or right. You know what I mean? And
yes.
That's comforting in a lot of ways.
Mm.
Yeah.
So Molly, what was it like to move back? Like, had the city changed significantly, or had you changed, you know, that made you sort of relate to it in a different way?
I mean, I guess the thing is, my mother taught at schools, and so I followed the gravy train. So my brother and I went to Hampden Hall, and then we went to Hopkins. And so, like, we just got shuttled around between sports practices and, like, piano and stuff like that. So I loved the old movie theater that was downtown. I loved Cutler's. I loved a lot of things that then weren't here.
Yeah.
You know, and so that was a little...
When did you move back?
We moved back 5 years ago.
Yeah.
So, I mean, obviously I've been coming back for Christmas and sure. stuff like that, but, and noticing, and at first you're like, oh, cool, we have an Apple store. Oh, well, great, you know? And like, oh, Cutler's closed. That's too bad. But I had never tried to really, like, be a part of the community. And when we moved back, it was finally like, hey, there's a Pecha Kucha happening, and hey, there's an ecstatic dance, and that's what I was into in Austin. And hey, there really is everything, and there's all these different cool communities, and you can kind of navigate them, and then you might bump into somebody at the little supermarket or whatever, you know? And so it just started to feel like really friendly. And like, people were doing work. Also, the times have changed, and I'm aware about, like, political issues in a way that I wasn't before. So all of a sudden I'm looking around, I'm like, wow, Love 146 does an incredible job. Like, wow, you know, oh wow, Amistad Academy is righteous. So, I'm older. I'm more interested in that stuff. And it's not that I didn't like it before. I liked growing up here, but I didn't feel like I knew New Haven. I was just a kid going to school.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And your dad loved the city, right?
My dad did love New Haven. I mean, he was on, like, all kinds of boards of education, and he used to fight hard. They always were trying to, like, sink the highway under, you know, because it cuts the highway cuts off our access to the water. And so every 10 years there would be a thing like, oh, maybe it's going to actually happen, and they're going to sink the highway, or they're going to come up with some creative solution. But he was pretty passionate about New Haven, so it was cool.
Yeah.
To have that.
Right. So in making this album, as you describe your sort of domestic life, as, you know, the way you're both describing it, is it was like, oh wow, we really have to sort of, like, buckle down and, you know, do this.
Be a team.
Yes.
Yeah.
So in all the sort of, I have a kid also, so it's hard to describe that thing where it feels so frenetic from a minute to minute level. At the same time, it's like you spend the whole day in the house. You know, there's
working for yourself, you're just like a rat in a cage, like just going crazy.
So how long did it take to put this album together, like, as you're juggling, you know, your own separate music projects and raising a kid and just sort of being a household and all of those things?
I think we figured out, we started working on this too. I mean, some of the recordings that are on this album now we recorded in my mother's living room, like, 2 years ago. I mean, one track in particular, but a lot of the writing happened right after Otis was born, so that would be like 2 years, 3 months ago. And then over the last year, it's been kind of like nonstop, you know, recording and recording in New York, and then mixing, and then recording more, and overdubbing, and just, it became like a really cool creative outlet for Eben in particular, I think. He's writing string parts and playing some crazy stuff and new sounds, exploring. It was a long, it's kind of long.
Yeah, it was a long process, but things have changed in that, you know, in the way records get made now too, with the quality of what you can have at your house. And so what we did, which is very typical, is right about the time of the travel ban, I remember, because we were in the studio. We cut the basics then, which must have been January or February of 2017.
Yeah, last year.
So we brought the band and we did
it's
all.
It's only been a year since the travel ban.
I know, right? Yikes!
Long year.
Yes.
We were in the studio in Brooklyn cutting the basic tracks, which means that what that means is the band comes in and you do bass, drums, and guitars, and and whatever other instruments are on the track. And then from there, we started the process of doing all the vocals, and we did all the vocals and all the overdubs at home, which has become Adam Chalensky, the co-producer, has a studio in his house as well, and he did a lot of the keyboards and had a lot of session guys from New York come through that studio, and we focused on the vocals and my guitars and some other special effects type stuff, and in our home studio, and that's become somewhat typical these days.
So. Yeah, right.
And doing the vocals at home was awesome. I finally clicked into it this time because I'm not someone who's great at details or listening back and making adjustments, but I really like to perform. I like that it's one take and like that's just it, and whatever it is the moment that you had. And somehow I was able to get into that when I would just be in it alone. Like literally I just have to know how to press three buttons, and I was like, Evan, get out of here. And I would just like sit there alone and do a couple takes. Like no one can even hear me when I'm doing it. And that gave me a lot of freedom. And then Evan would listen back and he'd listen through the takes and be like, do you hear what you're doing here? And he'd have really good pointers. And that was okay. Like I could take it then and maybe run a few passes on it. But while I was singing, I felt like I would turn the lights off. I'm just like, this is really just my own experience. So that's, you can never do that in a studio because at least there's a sound engineer and I'm like self-conscious. So
also, yeah, cool. You don't, I mean, most people don't really have a real producer in as much. I mean, most people don't have Quincy Jones, you know, I mean, very few people have Quincy Jones.
very few.
It's a pretty big difference between, you know, being in charge in some way and having your name, say, produced by on the back of a record, and actually being in there take to take with the vocalist and nursing out, you know, the performance, get like working on the technique of how it's being delivered, where the breaths are and this kind of thing. And I say that because it was a pleasure for me to have that opportunity when so much of the time you're operating on in a situation where you have limited time in the studio, and it is what it is. And that's really not the way that it's supposed to be done. The famous Quincy Jones quote is working with Michael Jackson. He says, that was great. That was just spectacular. You're spot on, Michael. That's excellent. It's excellent. Let's just do one more.
Yes.
You know, like perfect, perfect. You nailed it. One more.
Right. I mean, there is a way that like recording at home is like, it's quite luxurious, right? Like the tape is free.
Yeah.
yeah, your time is your time.
Yeah.
You know, however many hours it takes.
When you blow deadline after deadline after deadline,
yeah, it's
blown and blown and blown and blown. You start to feel, you know, a little bit deranged. Like it literally will drive you crazy. Like, what are we doing in this room? You know, like, how can we justify another $80 of babysitting for that? Like, what are we doing?
Right.
But
I've never been more proud of anything. I mean, and I don't say that. I've never even said anything like that before. Usually I like the songs. And I'm like, yeah, that was a good moment. Okay, got it. Yep, sure. That's what it was. But this actually feels like a piece of art that we took our time with. And yeah, it feels really good. I'm not even sick of it yet.
Cool.
So great.
It's nice that you said that because I think people are usually totally sick of the thing by the time it comes out.
I mean,
I need a little space from it at least, you know?
Right. We did have a little space in terms of like we would send it off to get mixed and then it would take a little while. And then we went on tour with Red Molly. So we just couldn't do anything for a month and then we'd come back to it. So it was this really surprising experience of then hearing back the mixes and going, oh, this is really good. I forgot about this song. I like this song, you know, and then hearing things too, like, you know what? I don't want that as banjo. I want that as guitar, like do it over. So it was great. It was a really cool experience and we probably won't have the opportunity to record something on this magnitude for a couple of years. So I'm glad I still like it. Yeah.
Let's in the interest of being super nerdy, to round out this thing, what do you think is the best one to play that would then let us get into the weeds about how it was put together?
About what?
About how this particular song was put together.
What about like I Love You Goodbye?
Or so, I mean, if you want to hear a string arrangement, you should do I Love You Goodbye. But if you want to hear the most whacked out one,
I think that's what I'm asking for.
What? Which is whacked out.
I mean, scientist and in the end are the end of the first side and the beginning of the next side.
Mm-hmm.
If you think of it as sides anymore. Eventually,
people do like Scientist. Yeah. And that's the oldest song on the album. So that's the one if I was sick of any, it'd be that. But it's the oldest song, but people seem to respond and it does get a little trippity.
Let's hear it.
That's 7.
Well, I thought a lot about it. Annie, I know I let you down. Cause I've fallen in so deep this time, I can't see my own way out. All the plans that fell through, finally getting to you now. So it's heavy in the air, and it's thick on my tongue, an empty promise that I settle on you now. So they're heavy in the air, and they're thick on my tongue. Hollow words I wish that I could meet. I heard the scientists say there are laws we all obey. I heard the holy man say that it's all just prearranged. So what's the difference anyway, if I try to change?
That was Scientist from Goodnight Moonshine, and you're listening to Northern Remedy here on WNHHLP 103.5 FM. I'm your host, Brian Slattery. I'm the arts editor of the New Haven Independent, and with me here in the studio are is Goodnight Moonshine, which are Molly Venter and Evan Pariser. So that song was Scientist off of the new album, I'm the Only One Who Will Tell You When You're Bad. And they're celebrating the release of this album this weekend at the Ballroom of the Outer Space.
That's right. It's technically the pre-release, like the street date isn't for a few months, but we've got some copies in hand to sell, and we are starting to celebrate the finishing of this record.
I think we're allowed to. give a little hometown celebration before things really kick off.
Heck yeah.
Just for our own selves.
Feel good.
For sure. So I'm glad that you picked that one because there is a lot to talk about. How did that song start out? What was the first version?
The first version was acoustic guitar, electric guitar, and two voices.
Mm-hmm.
And we played it and performed it probably around 2016, 2015, 2016.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe even earlier. That song may have been written many years back. I can't remember. It might have been written all the way back in 2013, 2014. I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. But the original version was just a folk duo version. And
there's no reason it could have stayed that way, right? Technically.
Right. So then we started to demo it up. That was one of the first of two songs that we began to, or two or three songs that we began to demo up, thinking, not knowing what direction that record was going to go, but knowing we were going to start to make a new record and thinking maybe it would be something stripped down that we just produced at home. We didn't know. We had a bunch of ideas, but we weren't totally sure how it was going to turn out. And that version encompassed the two guitars, recorded the guitar in the basement with a stereo mic about 4 feet away. So it's got like the, you know, cement reverberations from the basement,
right?
And a stereo sound. And I took the tremolo. I recorded the whole part in both tremolo and not tremolo, but I didn't like how it sounded on the notey parts. So I just would cut the tails onto the guitar part so that the tails would have the tremolo, but the first part, the notey parts, would have clean sound.
All right.
And then we put a bass line in and recorded some Steinway pads and turned them backwards, recorded a little more piano stuff, and that was the first demo version. And it was around this time that I started to say, I don't think this is going to work well if it's just me and you. Like, I think I want to ask Adam if he wants to co-produce it. And so we gave him the handful of tracks that we had started, and that was one of them. And he was just like, drums, 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 drums. So what we did was we went into the studio and we recorded bass and drums for it with a scratch track from Molly. That was from the demo that I had already recorded. So at the end of the day, we used the original guitar parts, the original piano parts, and then Molly added, we added a new acoustic guitar part, a new lead vocal, a new backup vocal, and then at the end of the song, we added a string quartet and trumpet and some tape effects by an old New Haven genius
Who Eric
now
Tate.
Is in Denver, but Eric Tate did the special effects at the end. I think that's everything. Adam played the organ.
Yeah,
so he's got an organ.
That's the one that feels a lot like a sculpture, where you're just like, I don't know, I'm just chipping away. I'm just still seeing what is coming out. I don't think it's quite revealed itself yet. I'm gonna, there's a little more. So, I mean, Evan did it, but it was great.
And it actually kind of works that way as the song, too. Like, it starts off very simply, and then elements keep getting added and keep getting added as the song goes on.
And the song, I mean, content-wise, I think it works, too. That's like, while I'm listening back, I'm like, God, this is a sad song. Like, that's a song about struggling with your demons. And I had been listening to all these, I'm a podcast junkie, and there was some Krista Tippett I was listening to about, you know, this idea, like, are things prearranged, or do we even have free will? And, you know, or are you just a product of everything that's happened before? And, what's the point of trying to change? So anyway, all that stuff was
which are valid thoughts to have as you have a small child around also.
Right? I mean, and this was just after we had been married, I guess. And yeah, it's confounded. But for anyone who's ever just kind of struggled with, you know, or your own behaviors or your own thoughts, that's kind of what it was for me. So to hear it kind of get constructed, it builds up, and then it kind of decomposes at the end, felt really right on for the meaning of the song for me.
Mm-hmm. So when you say that you're going through this process of going, like, it's not quite done, it's not quite done, it's not quite done. How do you know that it's done now?
I mean, the short answer is you don't, right. I mean, this, you know that it's done because we just ordered several thousand of these C compact discs. And so it's not going, we can't turn back time and we're going to sell this. Right. So this one is done.
Right.
Yeah, no, I mean, it was sort of a, it was a lot, it mirrored the process that was going on in our lives, which is doing the best we can with the time that we have and relinquishing a lot of control over things. And so I just remember, you know, that the time came where after months of scheduling, it was time to go to New York and record the string quartet. And so the night before, I was finishing the parts. I was writing as many parts as I could think of for as many songs as I could think of to see how much we could get, you know, and we did get them all. We got them on five. And that was kind of, that's kind of the spirit of the whole thing is, you know, I really want trumpet here and here. You know, I have a longtime friend and a great musician in New York. And so I wrote the parts and sent them to Adam. Adam had him come by the studio. Anything that could kind of get done without blowing too many deadlines, basically.
Yeah, right. I mean, you're getting at a kind of cool point, right? Which is that there are people who tweak and tweak and tweak their records to the point where they never come out.
Right.
Right. And like, The music world is full of examples of that, right? Of people who are still trying to get it right, and you know, 20 years go by and they're still like, I'm still working on it.
Yeah, or like a book, right? I could see that happening too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Probably better that there was more than one of us, because somebody might get really in deep with something. Like, I would start doing that with other songs or with vocals or with something, be like, oh, you know what? I don't think... You know, and Evan be like, no, that's good. That is good. That is what we are going with, you know? And so sometimes you have to kind of steer each other like, yeah, like that, like, that actually
is good.
You know,
we do want to put this out this year.
Right, right, right.
You looked like you were going to say something, which is the only reason I...
The inhale.
No, not going to.
Well, what made you say, like, because the end has this very, like, suddenly, like, production number quality to it. So at what point did you get from, you know, I'm going to do what I can with the instruments I can play and with the instruments that you know, I know.
Overnight. As soon as it was decided that we were going to do basics in the studio, then it was like, well, we're going to do anything that occurs to us then. Because that's
now
really...
we're going to keep going.
That's really... You work within the constraints that you have. So there's still constraints. I mean, there's still financial constraints and there's still logistical constraints.
Right.
But there will compared to working with the instruments that you have and the equipment you have in your house, now it's just all I have to do is make one phone call and then so-and-so can pop down to Adam's studio. Like, it's just, it becomes a no-brainer to do things that simply would have been a huge headache, but also wouldn't have worked with the aesthetic before. So it just so I guess it's, you know, and some of that's just plain experience, I guess, with having put these together time and time and time again. You know, there are some rules, or some rules of thumb anyway, that you come to focus on making sure your vocal performances are... Put 90% of your focus on the vocal performances, you know. Don't use a band take unless it's a good band take, you know. I mean, and then don't F around with your band take. You get one that's good, a good live band take, and then don't second guess it. Right. If it's got a good feel, you know, it's not necessarily, it's, you
not every
don't
note has
mess
to be
around
perfect.
With it. Yeah. Understand that as a thing, it has a spirit, and that... Yeah, I mean, of course, you got somebody who clams a bass note, you're going to fix it. But, you know, that's the type of thing where you say, like, well, that's perfect, except for that one stupid thing there. Like, we'll just use that. And
yes.
That, we'll fix that one thing, and then that's it, you know? So, you know, those are some things. And then if you have an idea, use it. So if you have a melody in your head, use it. Find a way to put it on the record. If you have an idea for something, do it, you know? And then when you run out of ideas... Be done with your ideas.
Right. Yeah, I guess that's what happened. We ran out of ideas. Yeah.
Right.
I was like, yeah, those were all our ideas.
Well, you're doing a nice, I mean, you're doing it, I feel like with that, there's this kind of like final piece of this interview puzzle that has fallen into place, and in that this feels like a real like culmination of, you know, the album really does draw on like a lot of what you guys did in the past, you know, by... You know, not just your own musical experience, but also the collaborators that you've managed to gain over the course of your career. Like,
that's true.
Like, on one hand, it may feel like a solo project, and on the other hand, it feels like a small army project.
That's another interesting point is, wow. And I haven't been the best at this in my life. But it's something to aspire to, is to just really treasure and support and be grateful for the people that are working with you, even if it's just one person or two people, that because they don't stick around otherwise, for one thing. And you don't get to the point where you have a huge network or resource. If you're not great, you know, if you're not grateful for what you had when you started, you know, the reality is I'm working with the same people I started working with when I got out, you know, when I got to New York in 2006, and I'm working with 10 times more other people too.
Right. People you've met along the way.
So, you know, that knowledge that, you know, you're lucky if you have one person who's taken an interest in what you do, that can take you far, and it's hard, and I've definitely not been the best at that, but I think it's part of what has allowed us, however good I've been at it or we've been at it, is part of what has allowed us to eventually assemble this many parts, you know. And I'm super loyal, you know, the same guys mastered all of my records, and you know.
Yeah, nice. Well, if it ain't broke, right?
What? Yeah exactly.
Yeah, definitely. Do you have anything else to add?
No.
You don't have to. I just wanted to make sure.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like that's about as good a note as we can end on. Aside from hearing something else from the album.
Well, can we just remind people that we got the show coming up January 19th?
Please do.
That's this Friday.
And then tell me about the other things that are happening at the show, because there are other things that are happening at the show.
Right. So one thing I did want to mention is Sonia Salazar is the head chef at Barracuda Bar and Bistro, and
she's well beloved.
She
staff.
Is
she's
beloved so by awesome. Me,
yes,
personally, and she's an official sponsor of the show. And awesome. So I just want to mention it's one more reason to go to kind of the coolest, in Molly and I's view, one of the coolest spots, if not the coolest spot to hang out in New Haven. I feel like the place really has a vibe where there's active intermixing of people from different backgrounds here, which is often the biggest criticism of the city, is just there's this Yale enclave, and then there's sort of like a depressed like inner city, and and there's so much that could happen in the interface of those things, and it doesn't. And this is just kind of one of those places where it's just like you walk in and you take a breath of relief, because it's just like, yeah, thank you. Like a place that actually, this is what I know New Haven is, you know what I mean? But you never see a room full of people like that, almost never, it feels like. So, and the food is tremendous. So thank her for, go in there and thank her for sponsoring the show. And yes.
We've got our friends opening the show, the Let Loose, and they're a total New Haven band, five guys. The show starts at 7, and then Goodnight Moonshine will do our set, joined by Roosevelt Dime, and then Roosevelt Dime, Evan's Boogie Woogie Bluegrass. No, that's not the way. It's Rhythm and Blues.
Rhythm and Blues based Americana. It's New Orleans derivative, kind of modern folk.
They're going to close the night with like an awesome dance set, so you'll get all your itches scratched. What? There you are.
That works.
There you have it. Yeah.
So what else? What song should we take this out on?
What do you think? I like We Need You. I like Love You Goodbye.
Let's give him Keep the Spark to end with.
Oh yeah, that's kind of friendly. And that's the last one.
It's the very last one.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what had you decide to end the album with this one?
We worked on the playlist for a while, and I can't go through the every step of the deliberation.
It's like so long figuring out order.
But part of it is that Roosevelt Dime is a centerpiece for the sound of the band. Roosevelt Dime as a backing, as it backs up Molly and Molly and me, is a centerpiece for the record. So this kind of gives it that repeat factor a little bit. So it ends, and then with a Roosevelt, with a track that features Roosevelt Dime, and then starts again with a track that features Roosevelt Dime.
Which would give you a good excuse to just like start over.
Yeah, again. It's just the repeat factor.
Those are my favorite albums, actually, that just make you want to like go back to the beginning again. Going,
you don't know going. Where you are. It's just a circle.
Right. So you can just keep playing it over and yeah. over. Those are always my favorites.
And there's songs on this album. There's just a lot of stuff about relationships with other people, like our families. You know, Evan's got one on his brother. I've got a song for my dad. I've got a song for Otis. There's just, you know, there's a song about missing our friends.
And like relationship, what the relationships or the breakdown of in, you know, our larger society.
Right. There's like basically a protest song in there. So there's a lot of different stuff, but it starts and ends again with kind of our little nuclear relationship. But the last one, 14, is just kind of has like a sweet twist on it, I think.
It's a very adult song.
It's like adult and contemporary, but not adult contemporary.
Oh, gosh. Right. No, it's actually world music kind of thing, but we'll see.
Nice. Well, you've been listening to Northern Remedy here on WNHHLP 103.5 FM. I've been talking to Goodnight Moonshine.
We brought down the house just then, actually.
Yes. If you could only see what we're seeing right now. We're just
Evan staring down the walls.
The walls are falling down around us. New Haven can't handle this.
Well, thank you so much for coming in. This has been really fun.
All right, Brian. Thanks, you.
Thank you.